Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Drs. Darcia Narvaez and Gabe Bradshaw. Dr. Darcia Narvaez is a professor of psychology emerita at the University of Notre Dame, and Dr. Gabe Bradshaw is a psychologist and ecologist and director of the Carolus Center for Nonviolence. And today we're focusing on their book, The Evolved Nest, Nature's Way of Raising Children and Creating Connected Communities. So welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you both on.
Great to be here.
So I would like to start by asking, what is exactly the premise of the book and what is an evolved nest?
Well, every animal has a nest for raising its young. It's a developmental system that has been shaped through evolution to optimize normal development. And so these are just part of our adaptation as animals.
And are these species specific, or are they, or are there some commonalities across species?
There are commonalities and differences too. So it's that's what's fun about the book, is that we note the similarities and then we point out, oh, look at how they do it. That this animal species does it this way, and that kind of thing. So it's just a way of raising the young that is about nurturance and meeting the needs of the young, the basic needs, without delay, without, you know, depending on the species, what that means, and to foster a sense of connectedness, of safety, of security, and of physiological, mental, psychological well-being.
Yeah, I think what the book does is really cements what has been known in Western science for hundreds of years, actually, but in particular the last decades when neuroscience has come to the fore, and that's that all animals, and now there's going to be including the data and theory and experimentation on plants, trees, etc., that we all share the same capacities and structures of the brain, or of the system that gives us the capacity to think, feel, love, and dream, and all of those things. So that's really been known, but it's been quite tacit. And this particular book and our collaboration really has shown that there's that we're all the same. It's rather than differences, the emphasis is on diversity. So when you're saying, is there species specific? Yes, there is, just like there are among human cultures. And I think that that's probably the best way to readers and listeners to approach this, is saying, oh, you know, we're all the same, and yet we interact and we express our interactions and experiences where we live and our history in different ways, just as we look at different human cultures.
So there are very different aspects of child rearing and how individuals from the same family or community establish relationships among themselves that you explore in the book. We don't have time here, of course, to get into all of them, but let's get perhaps into a few examples. So could you tell us perhaps how mothers and allomothers, the role they play basically in, for example, African elephant societies?
Well, I'll start, and Darcia, you can fill in with things. African elephants are a prime example. They've been extremely well studied by science, and a lot of humans have a lot of affinity for them. Just to clarify, allomother, mother usually refers to the individual, what we would call the biological or the primary caregiver that is female, that would nurse, et cetera, and give birth to an individual. Allomothers are other mothers. And that is really the norm among most human societies traditionally, as well as animal societies. So in the African elephants is that a baby is born to a particular female elephant, and prior to the birth, that mother and the baby who's in the mother is immersed in this constellation of allomothers, other mothers. There are siblings There's, you know, teenagers, there's cousins and babies, and they're really this sort of organism that moves around and is there to support the mother prior to the birthing, which takes 2 years in African elephants, a gestation, and afterwards. So immediately when the baby is comes into the world from the mother's womb, he or she is literally surrounded by other elephants and family members and supporters. So you have seamless connection of being in this community. And I think as we go on, it, really in the sense of looking at the evolved nest and child rearing and child birthing, et cetera, the implicit, which really should be made more explicit, is the need and the role of a community. So it's not just the mother, it's not just the father, it's really a community effort, of which the focal element, of course, is the birthing mother or birthing parent and the child.
And of course, go ahead, sorry.
It's interesting that our species, we are apes. We come from shared lineages with monkeys earlier, and monkeys tend to share and have allomothering going on, other nurturers, and they share their babies around. But all the other apes, except us, keep, it's just a mother that keeps her child because she doesn't trust the others. And they evolved then to just have mothers taking care of their young. But humans, we brought back the allomothering according to the evolutionary ethology data. Mm-hmm. And that's really important for us because it actually shapes the brain to be much more flexible in social relations. Because if you're only with one mother, at least for humans, you tend to be much more rigid about how to get along with others because you only have practice with one, really, you know, in the first years. So you want to have a set of nurturers, people who are responsive. It's good for the baby, but it's also good for mother because babies, the evolved nest is, you know, rather demanding for in terms of baby care. We are like fetuses when we're born, fetuses of other animals, for at least the 18 months, the first 18 months of age. And so babies need to feel like they're still in the womb. And that requires a lot of holding, and moms just can't do it all. It's like, what? So that's why our species perhaps went back to this collective child raising. And the anthropologists tell us that it actually shaped our big social brain to have cooperative child raising so that we could have others providing the many calories we need to build a big brain.
So you mentioned holding the baby there. What is the importance of physical contact for the baby and also, by the way, for the mother or the other people who take care of it?
Well, in the neuroscience is telling us that the touch is central to helping establish well-functioning biological systems like the vagus nerve, the 10th cranial nerve that innervates all the major systems of the body. And it's been it's also fostered by breastfeeding. But touch is really important for that. And if you don't get the vagus nerve well established, you might have then health problems of various kinds later, you know, digestive issues, heart, lung issues, brain seizures, that kind of thing when the vagus nerve is malfunctioning. It's also the oxytocin system. You want the endocrine systems to be established properly, and touch really has a lot to do with that. You want to have that cuddle hormone that carries you forward so you know, you actually like to be with people and like to touch them and feel comforted by that. So there's many different neurobiological aspects that are affected by touch. It's calming. It, of course, is going to have epigenetic effects, turning genes on and off that are going to be oriented to good health. And touch needs to be positive touch, not negative touch. We've got a lot of data now on how even spanking a child is like physical abuse or emotional abuse in its long-term effects, making the individual more aggressive, less empathic, and sensitive to others.
I think even at a deeper level, when we look at touch and we look at the allomothering or the alloparenting, it really underscores that we're not these isolated units, that essentially, yes, there is an individual that comes into the world, but that's like a piece of a bigger puzzle or a piece of the tapestry. And so what we see on the outside, you know, what Darsha was explaining, and then looking from the neurosciences perspective, what's happening on the inside from a science perspective, is really a reflection of the reality of oneness and connection. Even if, as in the case of the brown bear, that's a chapter in our book, there isn't an aloe family per se. It's a mother bear who births the babies. And it's the hibernation den, which is really the sort of the equivalent of the aloe mothering elephants, et cetera. But it's really the environment. And so in another way, too, it erases the difference between social and ecological. Those are just sort of different elements of the same theme. So there is this continuity. There is this coherence. And we see that as expressed in terms of what Darsha is describing as touch. And positive touch in that way. So, you know, it goes beyond the material. And the neuroscience is just one way of sort of keeping track of what those little pieces are from the perspective of what science and our culture, modern culture, has relied on, which is dualism. But really, we're looking at non-dual consciousness. We're really looking at this coherence of oneness.
So we've mentioned mothers and aloe mothers here. What about grandmothers and the other older people in the community? What is basically the role played by elders in human and non-human societies?
Well, they are part of the aloe parents, aloe mothers, other nurturers, right? And there's a grandmother hypothesis that the reason that women, women exist, live beyond menopause, is so that they can take care of the young, because that, again, the young, our young, need a lot of calories. And there's data showing that when you have the grandmother around, the mother's mother, children do better. They have more, you know, better health and so on. So that's kind of more of a anthropological view. The indigenous perspective, of course, is that elders hold the wisdom of the community, and they're repositories, and they have all the stories and experiences that help the community survive and thrive wherever they are. So it's very landscape specific. The language is from the landscape, and they are essential for the well-being of the community, and their care of the very young children is just ideal, because they both are sort of still in tune or attuned to the unmanifest realm, the spiritual realm, and they're not so focused on, you know, working and like adults are. So they really get along well, and the grandparents are much more forgiving and less rigid and so on with the very young. So that actually knits together the community. And when the Native Americans in Canada and the U.S. were considered savage, and the governments wanted to break down, make them, you know, kill the Indian and save the soul, they broke up those relationships, taking the children away. And it really devastated the communities, because the elders didn't have the young as an anchor for themselves, and the young didn't have the community to foster their culture and language and so on. So the intergenerational violence continues from those horrible genocidal treatments.
And of course, when we talk about child rearing, we tend to focus a lot on the mother and sometimes also other females. But what about the father? Could you tell us perhaps about the example of emperor penguins and the role that fathers play there?
We love emperor penguins, of course. I'll start off. I think a lot of people, they've been popularized in movies, I've heard, and things like that. But the emperor penguins live in the Antarctic, and they're around 4 feet high. And just a kind of a cartoon sketch of the community is that the mother and the father meet, and they form partnerships and make love. And then the mother produces this amazing single egg. And it's very, very cold there. The conditions are very, very harsh. And so she eventually lays the egg, and is essentially, when she does that, it's almost immediately passed to the father, who is now receives the egg and immediately puts it under his feathers in this pouch. And the purpose of that is because the extreme cold there, the wind chill factor, is, makes it even greater. And he takes care of the egg while the egg is becoming a baby. And the mothers, they live in a colony. I mean, there's are these individual pairs and different relationships, but they are within a community. It's a colony. And the mothers essentially all leave at that time. They birth roughly probably at the same time, and they go up to a couple hundred kilometers away off the ice and into the ocean. And that is to replenish, because all of their energies have been diverted and directed toward creating the egg and all the nutrients and psychological, emotional, everything has. So this is going off to replenish, and they spend a couple months there diving and looking for fish and resting up and replenishing. In the meanwhile, the fathers are gathering. They each have an egg. And again, it's very protected, and they gather in what's called a huddle, which are a group of fathers. And they do that, well, from a physical perspective, is that because it retains warmth, it becomes this kind of thermal unit by which the temperatures of the egg can be kept perfect, not too hot, not too cold. And in order to do that, they actually move, in a very choreographed way to the interior of the huddle, and then some go to the outside. So again, this is this coordination. Again, this is a community, so that there's a baby, but it's a community. And then the baby is born. And at that time, the mother returns. And essentially, then the fathers go off, and they are also depleted. Some have lost half their weight. They go to the ocean and replete. And then they come back. And it's a very emotional and very intense time, because typically the colonies are in the thousands, and they have to find their mother and their wife and child. So Dr. André Ancel, who's in France, who's a researcher, talks very beautifully about this, that they're very mindful. So again, we're talking about a community. And this is an important point, because they're all coordinating together. There isn't this notion of competition. There isn't this notion of me first or anything like that. They give particular calls. They each have their own idiolect call. And if the guy next to you is calling for his, they wait for until that person can call and identify. So eventually they're all brought back together, and they form a family. And it's very much, the term is co-parenting. So there's a very much coordinated at many scales between the mother and the father, including the egg, and then the mothers with the mothers, and the fathers with the fathers. And then again, as the baby matures, then there is a creche, a kind of a coalescing of all the young chicks, kind of like a kindergarten or whatever, but they're all together. There really isn't any kind of separation. And the other idea is that connection is with community, non-parents, and with each other in that way. So it, again, this is just an example, and we have examples in the chapter on gray wolves, which is different. But it, there does show the participation of males, and same with the elephants. I'll just put that in real quick, is that the baby elephants in Africa, they grow up in that natal family we described. And then when they're, 11, 12, 13, they are either pushed out or they go out and they join older males, what they call an all bull group or area. And they spend at least 15 years in association with this bull society, male society. So there is not that kind of segregation that we see. We see this very much cooperative, and I would say just not even a division. It's just everyone has the same goal, and they work with each other to make it work in the best way possible for the babies and each other.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess that one very important topic also to talk about here is attachment theory. I guess it is very important in the context of your book, as was originally developed, I think, by Dr. John Bowlby, and then over the decades further developed by other researchers and scholars. So what would you say are perhaps some of the main insights that we got from attachment theory when it comes to having a better understanding of perhaps the social needs that we and other species might have and how we establish social relationships with other people?
I'll start. Attachment has to do with relational belonging, essentially, and connectedness and maintaining that. Those years when the brain is growing so quickly that, you know, it's setting up its worldview, its sense of self, its sense of relationships. And so attachment promoting care, which is the evolved nest, then establish this deep sense of security and safety and relationships and skilled knowing how to, you know, stop and start relationships or conversations and recognizing who's trustworthy and just being able to maintain relationships across time. Babies have to learn a lot of nonverbal skills before language comes about around age two. And a lot of that is this relational kind of socio-emotional intelligence. So it has also to do with your own understanding of your own emotions and conveying those in ways that are appropriate with your relational experience in the moment.
And is it just about, or is it even primarily about the mother-infant dyad, or does it go beyond that? Because, I mean, at least when we commonly hear about attachment and attachment theory, it tends to be mostly focused on the mother, sometimes the other caregivers like the father, for example, but people do not at least commonly talk about other kinds of social relationships. But if I understand it correctly, it goes beyond that, right?
Right. So in Western civilization, which has become patriarchal and emphasized the nuclear family, all mm-hmm. you have is mom, dad, and the children, right? The emphasis of Western scholars has been to look at the mother-child dyad because that's the framework, the assumption that that's normal. But that isn't normal. Our species. Our species raised children in multiple aged, multi-gender groups. And so really the way I look at it is mother provides the first attachment and then she's the bridge to the attachment to everyone else around. So that even in some societies, I think the Mbuti, the infant after a few days is passed around to the group. Whatever size it is, and the baby starts to get a sense of different smells and different patterns of movement and gets comfortable with all that and builds a fabric of supportive care around them. So they become attached even more than just to people, to the natural world around them, to the animals and plants that they live with and interact with. And so it's much broader, this attachment, this sense of being belonging and connected and relationally kind of supported than what the Westerners are studying and talk about.
But what are essentially the factors that lead to the development of a secure attachment style and not, let's say, non-secure attachment style that could be an anxious, avoidant, or disorganized kind of attachment style?
Well, it has to do with the predictability of the caregivers. So providing the evolved nest, so providing breastfeeding when the child signals they want it, touch when in our ancestral context, nomadic foraging communities, babies aren't put down. They're carried everywhere because they know they had intuitions about how that baby is so vulnerable and required such intensive caregiving to develop well. And so the baby is having relationships that are always responsive and nurturing in terms of touch and just listening and emotionally honest and delightful. And in those situations, the baby learns that everything is, you know, you can predict it and I'm safe and these people are trustworthy and all that. Insecure attachment comes from inconsistent care where we see that not in nomadic foraging communities, unless there's been some horrible accident or something. But in modern culture, where babies are kind of, you know, more like possessions and objects of control, and when babies are left alone or left to cry and isolated physically, they're not going to feel that sense of belonging and safety and security. And so we, unfortunately, have cultural myths about how important it is to make babies independent, you know, and oh, you're going to spoil the baby if you pick them up too much, and all these crazy ideas that actually undermine health for the long term. So when you can, when you build an insecure attachment, which could be anxious or avoidant, depending on exactly when and how you were treated, when you're insecure, you're, it means your neurobiology has been shaped to be, you know, kind of dysregulated, and you don't maybe know how to make friends, and you don't know how to maintain a friendship, and you don't know how to recognize a trustworthy relationship. And so it gets you into all sorts of trouble. Professors tend to have avoidant attachment, which is this detached way of looking at things, not emotionally available, because that's how what they experienced as babies. And so it's very easy to go in the ivory tower and make up stuff, you know, and then apply your, you know, little model to the world. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but you get a publication, and, you know, you're not committed and emotionally attuned. And so we've created a world where we reward that kind of avoidant attachment with, you know, status and such. And that's destructive to the planet. It's destructive to nature, because we're not relationally attuned with our emotions, with our commitment, with our moral commitment to the well-being of everyone, human and non-human, around us.
And I would say that John Bowlby really made quite a contribution, because he really made visible the invisible, which was this notion of the importance of relationship and the quality of relationship. But within that, again, this is not a criticism, because that's a, it's a step in the evolution of the Western culture's way of looking at things. You're still having one thing attaching to another thing. And when you look through the lens of non-human nature, everyone's attached. There is no attachment. There are no strings. It's all one big soup. So, quote unquote, attachment is just the way animals live. And so that the specificity of it, for example, the importance of the mother with the nursing, the way Darsha was discussing it, or the way that the passing of the egg with the father, those are important elements, but it's all, everyone's attached. It's the non-attachment that Darsha was talking about, in the sense of some kind of perturbation, some kind of, you know, causing a gap or a schism between you and me, or, you know, the baby and the parent or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's the anomaly. And essentially, so like I said, when we look from through the baseline of non-human nature, there is no attachment. It's we are all attached. And that's really what we're coming back into. And the work that we've done together is really trying to bridge that and move us into this paradigm of the baseline of we're all attached. We just are in that way.
So the evolved nest is about meeting basic needs, everyone's basic needs. There's no argument about meeting the needs that you just provide. And that, and nature's gift economy is that way too. You take the fruit, and then you your waste becomes some other animal's food. And it's just this ongoing cycle of giving and taking and giving without a sense of disconnection, right? You're just in it, like Gay said, in the soup. And what the Western world has done is just divided and disconnected all over the place, disconnected body from mind, spirit from humanity. And it's just a big mess of division that we hope our book will help people realize that that's not the way we evolved to be, and that's not helpful for the planet.
I think what's a challenge, and we're hoping, as Darsha said, that the book will help, you know, support people make that shift, is essentially from one paradigm of dualism, we can call it dualism, pieces, you know, all the pieces, you, me, they, what, all those things, into oneness, into non-dualism. And it really takes either an experience or a leap of faith. but you at one point you have to kind of jump in. You have to jump in and say, do we see ourselves as you and me and separate, that we're putting together an assemblage? Or are we just one, of which I'm an expression, you're an expression of a part, etc.? And that's really what this is an example of encouraging people to jump into that new view, because then the other pieces, like the elements of the evolved nest, they just kind of come out naturally. I mean, there may be some questions like, well, how do I do this? How do I transition? You know, I don't have a grandparent or whatever. But then solutions start to come up. Okay, we don't have grandparents, but we have our neighbors. Let's start to talk with our neighbors and create this kind of, mosaic that moves into oneness.
So we're talking about interbeing, right? We are all... you are me, I am you. There's no real separation. We're just, little pieces of the whole, the implicate order. And our ability to de-differentiate ourselves, to see how we're alike, to see how we are connected and all in this flowing dynamic universe is really our aim here. And the animal images and how they know this, right? We have so much to learn from our animal kin. And so we hope that's what the book will promote. Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point there, you mentioned needs. What are needs exactly? Or perhaps a better question is, where do they come from exactly? What constitutes a child's need? And I mean, since, of course, in the book you explore other non-human species, does that mean that perhaps some of these needs are quote-unquote hardwired, or are children perhaps at least to some extent responsive to the ecology they develop in when it comes to developing their own specific needs?
Well, the way I look at it, and Gay can add her perception. The way I look at it is that we're animals, and so mm-hmm. we all know we need some nourishment, we need shelter, we need protection, we need warmth, mm-hmm. or else we die, right? But we're also mammals, social mammals, and we need affection to grow well. We need the touch, right? We need play to grow well. So basic needs to grow the optimal kind of member of the species. That's what you want to meet. And that's, we have to identify basic needs by what leads to optimality. And we also are humans. We need to have meaning and make meaning. And so the stories that our culture tells us guides our behavior and guides our desires, our experiences, build our desires, right? To be close and affectionate or distant and detached, right? Depending on kind of early experience you had. So basic needs really lead to optimization of the individual and the community. Now, Maslow has had his hierarchy of needs. He learned, he got inspired by the Blackfoot Nation, the Siksika, and unfortunately, he turned it upside down, because for the Blackfoot, self-actualization is fundamental and primary. And that's what the evolved nest does for each individual. It fosters your uniqueness. You can unfold and blossom because all your needs are being met and everybody loves you and you feel like you belong. But he put that as the end point. The end point for the Blackfoot is cultural perpetuity, community well-being, so that the culture will, and that means the bio community that in which you're entangled, is going to live into the future, 7 generations, right? And we, Maslow got very individualistic, which is the Western way, instead of this communal orientation that understands that we don't become our best selves unless we have those basic needs met all along the way throughout life.
Mm-hmm. And in what ways can early life experiences have far-reaching impacts?
Well, that's what I write about quite a bit in terms of morality, but it's also social capacities. So as I mentioned earlier, with insecure attachment, you're kind of hampered. You have a inability, unless you heal it later with some interventions, you get along that well with others. Now my work looks at how our early experience, if you stress a baby so that they learn to be stress reactive, because they've been stressed so much that stress response is easily triggered, that's going to shape how they act with others and their moral decisions, what's right, what's wrong. And in the moment, they'll be more likely to feel afraid and brace against others, brace against life, instead of being open-hearted and flexible, you know, and attuned. So that's going to affect how they think about the world. They'll be more likely to have scripted, rigid ideas of black and white, up and down, more oriented to dominance hierarchies. You know, you're either up or you're down. You're either a winner or a loser. That kind of orientation. And each moment they can bring, if they feel unsafe in the moment, they're going to go into that mode. And their morality then is going to affect everyone else.
I mean, we're seeing far-reaching, we're experiencing the far-reaching effects of early development. I mean, if you look at the history of humanity over the last, we'll just say 100, 200 years, it has been violent, it has been breaking down, it's been insecure attachment generating writ large. And none of that has been processed. So when you have someone who is severely traumatized through genocide, through poverty, through the industrial technological development, which has gotten intensified, they're thrust back into it. And there really isn't an ameliorative, there isn't a healing, a receiving healing community. So even though a baby is brought up in a certain, that's obviously very critical, but the community, in other words, the culture, has to be one that supports that individual. And if they're not, if they're the same thing, in a sense, you just continue on this very, very destructive path, which is what we see right now. And unfortunately, in the non-human world, that's why you're seeing PTSD, complex PTSD, just to use technical terms, among African elephants. Never existed. Nothing like that. The orcas off Spain. Nothing like that. And so, you know, we can just analyze it from a very narrow view of neuropsychology, but essentially you're seeing this profound ricocheting of, you know, one child experiencing insecure attachment and then it perpetuating without any kind of balance in terms of healing that individual. And there are individual cultures, human cultures, that have a very different way. When an individual, for whatever reason, sort of steps out the bounds of morality, what do? They do not expel that individual. They gather around, they absorb, it's inclusive. And again, it's what Darsha was talking, is about that interbeing. It's our responsibility for that person, that individual. And so that's, you know, these are elements of socialism, right? Where it has to do with the fact of that your poverty or my poverty or their problem, quote unquote, is my problem. So it's a very different, what this is really saying is that in order for us to heal, in order for us to bring cohesion and well-being back on the planet within our species and then the entire planet, which is made chaotic by our human behavior, is that we have to be inclusive. We don't shut them away in prisons. We don't stick people away and get rid of them. We bring them back. And a number of the indigenous societies, that's how they function. They sort of, you know, absorb that individual. And again, that's another lesson of the evolved nest. It's not just a person with a mother or with a father. It's an organism. So really, although we talk a lot about child raising and things like that, it really comes down to revitalizing those elements of the evolved nest, which are in, I think, chapter 10 or whatever, they're sort of listed. I mean, they're just kind of pointers to something which is much vaster. But that's really the focus, is that that's how we can start on the path. That's how we can break the cycle.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that perhaps some of the issues that we are experiencing in industrialized and post-industrial societies nowadays have to do with some of these more individualistic values that we have, where people are raised to think that perhaps they shouldn't try to depend so much on others, and there's not so much the sense of community. I mean, also because I guess that looking at our own evolutionary history and other species, we are very much dependent on others. And I mean, that idea that being just an isolated individual, and if it's not that, then you're like spoiled or something like that, and you are just completely over dependent on others. I mean, that's incorrect.
That's right. It's particularly strong here, I think, in the United States. And I think it's unfortunately spread, but it's considered something negative or bad to say, I need to something, you know, can you help me out?
Yeah.
There's a lot of shame associated with that and further rejection. So you get this spiral. So, you know, to show kind of vulnerability is really considered to be something is used on as prey. We have we've developed a predatorial culture. So when there's someone who shows vulnerability, they're rejected and they are preyed upon in that way. So again, the elements of that are, you know, sort of itemized in the evolved nest to highlight certain things really are paths and principles which can really help our culture, our species return to, I would believe, its natural goodness, whatever you want to call it, in that way.
Mm-hmm. So I can add a little bit more. When we undercare for young children, so don't provide the nest, we're undermining the development of the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere is scheduled to grow more rapidly, and it's the part of our brain that is oriented to dynamic relationships and living things and has a sense of, it's the seat of our self-regulation initially and empathy and higher consciousness. And when we under care for children, that's, you know, not developed so well. And then they have to rely on the survival systems that are innate. So that dominance, submission and territoriality and rivalry, all the things, part of the reptilian brain, right? I mean, it's insulting reptiles, but and then we send them to school and train their left brain. Left brain's all in the ego consciousness. It thinks it knows everything. It doesn't know very much. It's good at linear, you know, kind of analysis, but it can't deal with dynamism. It likes static objects, things it can measure, you know. And so the Western world has been taken over by the left hemisphere, and this is Ian McGilchrist's point, and is running us, of course, into the grave because we forgot how to develop, how to foster an integrated brain. Both halves are really important, but we have now put ourselves in the hands of this very detached, robotic part of ourselves and guided by survival systems. You know, so predation is part of the left brain's orientation, manipulation of the world.
Yeah, and as Darsha brought up, the notion of the reptilian brain is kind of an artifact from science, that reptiles, tortoises and alligators, rattlesnakes, they all have the same brain that we do. And they all show the same, what we would call pro-social behavior. They care for each other's young. They're non-aggressive. They're very community-oriented. And they don't strike in violence except, you know, when it's absolutely necessary. And so, you know, those are the kinds of myths which is also have come along with this, is separating ourselves. Oh, we're not like them. Now, whether that's another animal or whether it's another human, and valorizing these aspects that of the left brain in the language of neuroscience that Darsha has been talking about. And that's very, very deep conditioning. So in the case of, you know, this is this whole, you know, schooling the world, you know, even if you brought up, you know, and I can have personal experience, if you grow up in an evolved nest kind of situation, but you're shunted into this conveyor belt of, you know, it's kind of a sociopathy, you know, where you're basically punished in various ways, not just physical, but socially, all those things, you're conditioned into letting go of the right brain, into sort of squelching these wonderful and beautiful feelings inside that are natural, which seed and nurture those within those that you meet. So we're put into this conveyor belt, and then that becomes a matter of quote unquote survival. If you're not like this, then you don't belong and you're excluded. And unfortunately, it's evolved to such a system where it really comes down to, are you with us or are you against us? We see that in political systems, we see that in social systems, etc. So it's really this move to, taking back our wholeness, taking back ourselves. And in that, which is critical, is understanding that non-humans, that's why it works for billions of years. That's why nature has worked for billions of years. And so we can say, okay, I'm going to side with them. I'm going to side with nature. I want to be more like nature. I want to be more like the penguins. I want to be more like the wolves. And by making that kind of solidarity, that kind of commitment, saying, those are my people, these are my kin, then that in itself opens up an incredible amount of the life force that really is responsible for creating this incredible planet that we live on.
Mm-hmm. So I would like to ask you now, since in the book you talk a lot about what we can learn from traditional societies, indigenous societies, for example, because in modern industrialized and post-industrial societies, even with the issues that we have, some of them we've talked here about today, we still have many positive things, like, for example, some very positive technological advancements that make our lives better and easier. So I would like to ask you, how do you think we could perhaps strike a balance here between some of the positives of those more traditional societies without perhaps having to ditch the other positive things that we have in our industrialized societies?
Well, I think it's a tough question, actually, but there are traditional societies who weren't nomadic foragers, who have lived with localization, where they have their, they raise their own food, they have their own energy, they use the cycle of life on their farms, right? So the waste from the animals or themselves goes into the garden and grows as the natural fertilizer. So they're not poisoning the soil, they're not dishonoring the earth, and they have ways of being that are tuned in to the well-being of that landscape right there. So I think we have to go back to these small kind of communities. And then perhaps with the renewable energies, we can still maintain Zoom conversations, for example. Those are nice.
Yeah, I would like to keep having those.
Yeah, but we don't need so much. I mean, there's so much wastefulness in our, because it makes money for people and it raises the GDP, right? The more you waste. So we have to get back to understanding that we are relational beings, and every plant, animal, river, mountain is part of our kin. And we need to be concerned about their well-being and not be greedy for what we think we need. But, the early undercare is going to lead us to be more greedy and trying to make up for that hole we have in our heart from disconnection, from disrespected early childhood. So we have to kind of work at multiple levels, bring back the evolved nest for the young, re-nest the adults, get them calmed down, get them more tuned in to the cosmos, to their relational responsibilities, feel more at ease and at peace, being a member of the Earth community.
And so perhaps just one last question, and I have asked you about traditional societies. So when comparing ourselves to other animals, and we've gone through several examples here today, What do you think we can learn from them that would be applicable to human societies?
Well, I'll continue with what Darsha said. I don't think we need any of the things that we call human achievements. I mean, all of those things are prosthetics that are substitutes for what the evolved nest and the rest of nature lives by and provides. I mean, Zoom is wonderful because we get to meet you and each other and things like that. But if we were living together and whatever, we don't need that. I mean, I may have never met you, which would be sad. But at the same time, how sad? I mean, in other words, there's so much loss that is associated with the things that we think have gained us. I see these as our intermediate steps, and that we need to give up those kinds of things. They really keep us. I mean, right now, they provide an incredible ability to kind of revitalize and communicate and kind of get back to where we are. But none of the rest of the other species need what we say we need. And they do very well, and they're very happy. So all the things we cherish, like wellness and good relationships and security and peace, that's what the animal world has without modern humans. And so if it really gets down to that, I think we just really need to sort of say, well, we don't really need all these things. These are just transitional objects that move us into what Darsha was talking about. And life will be much better. So I think it's not just I think we need to aspire to be who the animals are and who the trees and the plants are.
And those with insecure attachment tend to be quite restless. They don't feel at ease, and because, of course, they didn't get their needs met, and so they're anxious. You know, where am I going to get them met? And so you try all these things, addictions and various things, to try to calm down. But if we provide the evolved nest, or when we have nested lives, we have a fullness of now. We feel connected to everything now, and we see all the dynamism, and we can hardly, you know, look away from the beauty of life. Whereas when you have an under-cared for, under-nested person, they're worried, and they're thinking about the past. Oh, I did all that wrong, and they're depressed about that. And then they're worried about the future, and they're hardly in the present moment, because they didn't get enough practice for it. They couldn't, I mean, it was too painful to be in the present moment. They had to dissociate when they were left alone to cry, or left alone abandoned in some way. So we have to get back to the fullness of right hemisphere functioning, the full integrated brain, where we feel, oh, this life is so beautiful, and we are all in it together. And let's, you know, sing, let's dance, let's play together. That's what we aim for. That's the flourishing human community that we see as our promise. We can still return to that. And so that's what we aim for.
And I think we see that individually. I think everyone, why it feels so nice to be in nature. Okay, there are no TVs. There are no iPhones. Just being in nature. And then also just things like, I mean, not everyone, but a lot of people have fun having a picnic or have fun going camping. Well, that's because there's not all those things, right? And there is that. So that those are sort of touch points and indicators that that's our natural path. That's our natural inclination to well-being and peace.
So we can all go find a sit spot near us where we can tune into nature and go there regularly, and that'll open up our senses. We can all be activists for our local rivers, creeks, forests, trees, animals, native animals, just get out there and be committed to the bio community that you're a member of.
Great. So I think that's a great message to end the interview on. The book is again The Evolved Nest, Nature's Way of Raising Children and Creating Connected Communities. I'm leaving a link to it in the description box of this interview. And by the way, would you like to tell people, apart from the book, where they can find you and your work on the internet?
The Evolved Nest evolvenest.org. And we have a movie on this that's based in this book. It's 8 minutes long there. And there's a couple other movies too that you can watch free. It's a nonprofit. So there's different tools for re-nesting. We have an Evolve Nest curriculum you can do on your own to learn about and then apply Evolve Nest principles.
And our website where there's material as well as Kerulos, it's www.kerulos.org. And that's the Kerulos Center for Nonviolence. So there's information there.
Great. So I'm adding that also to the description of the interview. And Drs. Narvaez and Bradshaw, thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Ricardo. Thank you.
Good to see you.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please consider supporting the show on Patreon and PayPal. The links are in the description down below. And also, please share, like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by NLITES Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at nlites.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Perga Larsen, Jerry Muller, Hans Frederick Sunde, Bernardo Seixas, Olaf Alex, Adam Castle, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Eric Eleni, John Connors, Philip Force Connolly, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Nassi, Zup, Mark Neves, Colin Holbrook, Simon Columbus, Phil Kavanagh, Mikkel Stormir, Samuel Andre, Francis Forte, Agnunes, Fergal Cousin, Hal Herzog, Nun Machado, Jonathan Librand, John Lunyar, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, João Weira, Tom Hummel, Sadus Friends, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Desaraújo, Romain Roach, Diego Londonio Correa, Anik Punta, Radana Rosmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pablo Stasevski, Alec Bach, Guy Madsen, Gary G. Hellman, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yegi, Paul Tolentino, John Barbosa, Julian Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Douglas Fry, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litsky, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Sunny Smith, John Wiseman, Daniel Friedman, William Buckner, Paul George Arnaud, Luke Loaki, Georgios Theophanous, Chris Williamson, Peter Wallazin, David Williams, Diogo Costa, Anton Eriksson, Charles Morey, Alex Shaw, Amari Martinez, Coralie Chevalier, Bangalore Atheists, Larry D. Lee Jr., Old Herringbone, Starry, Michael Bailey, Dan Sperber, Robert Grassi, Igor N., Jeff McMahon, Jake Zuhl, Barnabas Radix, Mark Campbell, Thomas Dobner, Luke Neeson, Chris Story, Kimberly Johnson, Benjamin Galbert, Jessica Nowicki, Linda Brandon, Nicholas Carlson, Ismael Benzliman, George Coriatis, Valentin Steinman, Paul Crowley's, Kate Von Goller, Alexander Hubbard, Liam Dunaway, B.R., Masood Ali Mohammadi, Perpendicular, Jonas Hertner, Ursula Goodenough, Gregory Hastings, and David Pinsoff. A special thanks to my producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Tom Van Agdam, Bernard Hugney, Curtis Dixon, Benedict Mueller, Thomas Trumbull, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Giancarlo Montenegro, Alnick Ortiz, Nick Golden, and Rosie. And to my executive producers, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriana, and Bogdan Canivet. Thank you for all.